Okay, we're beginning here, 10 lines down, on the top of Sadi Gimel Amud Aleph. Gemara is continuing the discussion which we began yesterday with regards to Adam Makne Davar Shelo Bali Olam. A person is able to transact with items that have yet to come into the world. The basic machloket about this involves, for instance, a case where a person sells the fruits on the tree, but the fruits on the tree have yet to come to fruition. They have yet to be on the tree. So he sells forward the production of the tree that has yet to exist. Over there you have a machloket tanaim as to whether davar shelo bali olam, you have the ability to grant that as a kinyan, and you can transact over that item, or is that not allowed, and therefore the kinyan has nothing on which to take effect, and the kinyan is meaningless in this case. That is a machloket tanaim. The Gemara says that that same machloket is applicable here by cases in which an individual wants to execute or accomplish something, but it's not in their power to accomplish it today. For instance, a person wants to marry a woman, but there's some impediment between him and this woman, whether it's the fact that the woman's married, or the fact that he's married to her sister, or the fact that there is some other variable that doesn't allow him to marry her today. But he proposes marriage to her in the future when those variables clear up. So the Gemara says that's the same issue, which is, does a person have the ability to propose a transaction in the future? In the case where he can accomplish it today, then he certainly can propose to have the transaction take effect in the future because it's within his power to do it today. But if it's not within his power to do it today, and he wants a transaction to take place in the future when these variables or impediments clear up, that's the equivalent of Adam Makne Davar Shelo Bali Olam. Equivalent of selling items that yet to exist in the world, like fruits that will grow on the tree. So it's over here, when the conditions will be ripe, these individuals can get married. So the Gemara here says that is a machloket tanaim. In addition to that, we had a machloket yesterday between Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua and Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak in explaining a Mishnah in Nidarim as to whether Rabbi Akiva subscribes to this principle of Adam Makne Davar Shelo Bali Olam. Person has the ability to transact or deal with items that have yet to come into the world, or not. Depending on their interpretation of that Mishnah, will determine whether Rabbi Akiva holds that way or not. We concluded yesterday with Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak's statement, which is that Rabbi Akiva thinks that Adam is Makne Davar Shelo Bali Olam, as well as a list of other Chachamim that also believe that. And that list included Rav Huna, Rav, Rabbi Yanai, Rabbi Chia, Rabbi, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Elezer ben Yaakov, and Rabbi Akiva. Rashi claims that these individuals are listed generation after generation, and one student learnt it from the Rebbe in front of him. It's a little difficult. Rabbi Akiva already points it out over here, and the Chabad Yoyer discusses it, that Rav was a Talmud, or a direct Talmud of Rabbi. Rabbi Meir was also a direct Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. So why doesn't Rav get it directly from Rabbi? Why does he have to go through Rabbi Yanai and Rabbi Chia in order to get to Rabbi? And the same is true with regards to Rabbi Meir. Why does he have to go through Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov to get to Rabbi Akiva? So what Rashi says might be true, that these are chronologically in order generation after generation, though it's not clear that they got the Mesorah generation after generation, one from the next. Might be that Rav got it from Rabbi, and so did Rabbi Yanai, and so did Rabbi Chia. They all got it from Rabbi. All three of them got it from Rabbi, but in chronological order, all these individuals believe that a person can transact in items that have yet to come to the world. Or in other terms, the way that we described before, a person can transact about an issue they do not have the ability to execute on today, but can execute on it in the future. What the Gemara wants to do now is establish that each one of these individuals, according to Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, really subscribes to this position. So Rav Huna, Mahi. Where do we find the fact that Rav Huna believes that Adam Makne Davar Shelo Bali Olam? Ditmar, because we have a member of Rav Huna, Hamocher Peru Degel L'Chaveiro, someone who sells the production of a tree forward. The fruit is not here yet, but he's selling the production to his friend. Amar Rav Huna, Ad Shelo Bali Olam, Yachol Lachzor Bo. Rav Huna says until the fruits are actually manifest on the tree, he can back out of the transaction. Mishi Bali Olam, once they now exist, the fruits, and Yachol Lachzor Bo, then he cannot go back on the transaction, because the kinyan was effective. Even though the transaction talked about a future product, nevertheless, since the transaction is effective once the product comes about, when that product is there, the fruits, then the transaction goes through, and he is now in a sale and purchase agreement that he can't back out of. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Amar, Af Shemi Ba'u Li'olam. Even once the fruits come on the tree, Yechol Lachzor Bo, he can back out of it, because Rav Nachman obviously believes that you cannot transact in the future. And so when you transacted before the fruits were there, it has no bearing, even when the fruits come to fruition, because you cannot transact in things that have yet to be there. And Amar Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman says, Modina, I agree with you, Rav Huna, di shamit v'achil, if the purchaser over here comes and grabs some of those fruits and eats them, lo mafkina mine, we don't take them away from him, because they did have a semblance of a transaction, even though it's not a binding transaction, they did have an agreement. So if he takes them, Beit Din's not going to come and interfere and try to take the fruits back, even though technically the transaction didn't go through. But clearly here you see a machlok between Rav Huna and Rav Nachman on the person's ability to transact in the future. Rav Huna says you can transact about the future, even though the transaction will not be effective until the object or the product is actually there, nevertheless it works. On the other hand, Rav Nachman believes you cannot transact in the future. We'll see in a second why the effectiveness of the transaction is not immediate and only takes effect in the future because of the way that they described it. We'll see that there are other cases over here where they actually get the transaction to be effective immediately. But the way that it was described in Rav Huna's statement, there was a transaction that took place that said, I'm selling you the fruits that will come onto this tree in the future. Rav Huna says that's effective once the fruits come. Rav Nachman says it's not effective, but we clearly see that Rav Huna believes that Adam makne davar shelo ba li'olam. Rav, how do we know that Rav also subscribes to this issue of Adam makne davar shelo ba li'olam? Dam Rav Huna amar Rav, because we have Rav Huna quoting in the name of Rav, ha'omer l'chaveiro, sadeh zu she'ani lokeach, this field which I'm purchasing, lishekechena knuya lach me'achshav. So if he says that field that I'm going to purchase in the future, when I purchase it, it will be yours effective immediately. Kana, it works. So here, first of all, you see a transaction about a future event. Right now, this individual does not have the right or the ability to grant the ownership of this land as a gift to this individual because he doesn't own it yet. And he's making a stipulation that when he purchases it in the future, it will be effective and allow him to have it as a gift. And so Rav says, Kana, it works. This party that he promised the gift to, he can take the gift because they made a kinyan, and that kinyan is binding. When he buys the property in the future, it will become effective. So it's clear here that Rav believes that you can transact about something in the future. Over here, again, it's not in his power to do it, but in the future, it will be in his power once he buys it. So since he transacted about something that will in the future be in his possession, that goes into effect immediately. Now, as Tosafot points out over here, there's a nuanced language over here, me'achshav. It says it's effective immediately. Tosafot asks, I don't understand. If you believe you can transact in items, shelo ba li'olam, that are not there, then why isn't the transaction binding immediately? What is this issue about saying me'achshav? Now, in a regular kinyan, for instance, you have a condition or some sort of stipulation in a transaction. All the items are extant, everything is available, they could transact today, but they decide together that they only want to transact in the future. In that situation, if the agreement is that the transaction will take effect once all the conditions are fulfilled, that means that the transaction only goes through or is binding at the moment that all the conditions are fulfilled. On the other hand, if the person says then, me'achshav, that from now it will be so, once all of these conditions are fulfilled, then retroactively the kinyan is effective from the moment that they ran into the agreement. And as soon as all the conditions are fulfilled, it's as if the kinyan or the ownership took place from that moment forward. So in a case where you transact forward on items that exist, then me'achshav tells you that the transaction is effective immediately, even though there is some sort of delay or stipulation that has to be accomplished before the transaction is complete. And then if you don't use achshav, then it's postponed until the time of the completion of the stipulations. At that point in time, the kinyan goes through. On the other hand, if you believe that you can transact about items in the future, then why do you ever have to say machshav? You can have a transaction today about the future, and the transaction is binding as soon as the objects come into being because you already transacted. What do you need the word machshav for at all? What does the word me'achshav do or benefit you in this case? So Tosafot explains it depends on the nature of the kinyan that is being put into effect over here. So in a situation where the item is extant currently, person can transact for a future delivery point or execution. For instance, it says that You are married to me, Lachar Lamajom, after 30 days. Then the Kinyan is effective today. And then after 30 days, he's married to the woman, assuming that nobody jumps the gun and comes in and makes the Kinyan in the interim, or is Mikadesh her in the interim. So why don't we say the same thing over here? Why do you need the word Me'achshav over here to make the Kinyan effective? So the Rabbeinu Tam is Mechadesh, and in general, when you separate between the execution of the Kinyan and the Chalut, the effectiveness of the Kinyan's effect has to still be there when the Kinyan is going to be effective. So for instance, when a person gives money in order to execute on the Kinyan, they give the money today. They say that this is going to be Kesef Kiddushin, and in 30 days we will be married with this Kesef Kiddushin. So he's executing the Kinyan currently, and the effectiveness of the Kinyan will be in 30 days. The effectiveness in 30 days will only take place if the impact of that Kinyan is still there. So for instance, by that Kesef, by that money, since he paid the money now, and until the other individual does what's obligated in them, that money still really belongs to the original purchaser or payer here. And therefore, if they don't execute on their side of it, the money has to be given back. So that means that the money only officially becomes either the woman's money or, in the transaction, the person who's selling the product's money once they actually go ahead and make the Kinyan effective by exchanging whatever they said for the money. So therefore, the impact of the Kinyan of the money is still felt at the time that it goes into effect. On the other hand, when it comes to a shtar, chazakah, or chalipin, chalipin is a momentary Kinyan. It happens at that moment. There's no lingering effect or impact of that. A shtar, yes, it has a lingering impact, assuming that the shtar is there. But if the shtar gets ripped up or ruined in the interim, the shtar is also not there. Chazakah, also, when you exert ownership over the property, it only has a momentary effect. And all three of those kinyanim, at the time that you do the maaseh kinyan, that's fine. But if the chaluta kinyan, if the effectiveness of the kinyan is postponed to a later date, then that kinyan or the impact of that kinyan is no longer around. The action that you took earlier, not there. Or if the shtar is burnt or lost, it's not there. And therefore, to ensure that the kinyan is effective, this individual says me'achshav. Me'achshav says that the Kinyan at the time that we execute it is effective at that moment. And since it's effective at that moment, therefore the impact of the Kinyan is still there when the effectiveness is. And then later on, once we finished executing in all the pieces, retroactively, the Kinyan or the ownership will start from that moment of the Kinyan. And therefore you prevent the problem. And for this reason, Rabbeinu Tam separates between items in which the Kinyan's impact is still felt and still around. There, you can have the Kinyan today and the effectiveness later on. But in items where the Kinyan's impact will not continue later on, then you must have the Chalut, the effectiveness of the Kinyan, be at the same moment that the Kinyan is actually executed. So based on that, he says, that's why over here by the property, Rav says that you use the word Machshav, because the normal Kinyanim that are used by property are Kinyanim that don't have a lasting impact. On the other hand, by the case of purchasing products where it's by money, or kiddushin where it's by money, there you can have the effectiveness of the Kinyan be much later on, because the effects of the money or the impact of the Kinyan is still there even after one has given the money over and executed on the Kinyan itself. Then Rabbi Yanai to Rabbi Chia. Rabbi Yanai and Rabbi Chia really comes from a similar or same story, which is the Rabbi Yanai Havle Arisa, Davi Maitile Kanta de Perik Homale Shabto. He had a sharecropper. He used to bring him as a gift every Erev Shabbat. He used to bring him fruits, a basket of fruits, or a measure of fruits every Erev Shabbat. Hau Yoma Nagale. On that day, he was tarrying, or he was late in bringing him the fruits. Vloato, and he didn't come before Shabbat. Shagal Asar Mi Perei Debeite. He went ahead and took off Masrot from the fruits of his house. Shagal Asar Mi Perei Debeite Alayu. He went ahead and he was mafrish trumot masrot from tevil that he had in his house, on the assumption that the individual would bring the items later. But when he brings the items later, it's going to be Shabbat. And we know that there's a restriction against taking trumot and masrot off on Shabbat. So in order to avoid that problem, he's mafrish in anticipation of the fact that this individual is bringing him these items. Now, as far as the items are concerned, if he was bringing him Rabbi Yanai's own fruit, then there'd be no question that Rabbi Yanai could be mafrish on those fruits, because he owns them. Wherever they are, he owns them. So it's clear here that the fruits that we're speaking about are the fruits of the aris of the sharecropper. And the sharecropper on a regular basis brought these to Rabbi Yanai on every Erev Shabbat. So in anticipation of receiving them that Erev Shabbat, where he will own them in the future, Rabbi Yanai was mafrish trumot masrot on something that he will own in the future. So using that vehicle of, I will, when I own this in the future, need to take off trumot masrot, and therefore I'm taking them off now from items that are with me, he went ahead and he was mafrish trumot masrot. After the kamei Rabbi Chiya, he came to Rabbi Chiya Amalei, Shapir Avat. Rabbi Chiya answered Rabbi Yanai, whatever you did was fine. How you acted is proper, Ditanya. The man to madirat Hashem lekecha kol hayamim. Elu shabbatot v'yamim tovim. The pasuk that comes to teach you that you have to fear Hashem all of the days, that refers to Shabbat Yom Tov, the Mai Hilchoto. What is that pasuk coming to teach you with regards to the fear of Shabbat and Yom Tov? Ilei milas surei umeichal. If it's coming to teach you that you're allowed to take off trumot masrot and eat on Shabbat and Yom Tov, it's trichra the meishrei tiltul derabanan. The restriction against taking off trumot and masrot is only a restriction mid derabanan. Truthfully, most of the Rishonim believe that it is a problem of mitake and kli. That it looks like you're actually fixing something, changing its status to be mutar. And since it looks like tikkun, the rabbanan were oser it. Over here, the Gemara uses the term tiltul derabanan, which is only a byproduct of that fact. Because you cannot take off trumot and masrot from the tevel then becomes a sur in tiltul or muksum either rabbanan because it has no value for you on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So the question is why the Gemara used tiltul instead of metakin kli. The Aruch Neir leaves it as a tzaruch hiyun. What you have to suggest is that the rabbanan saying tiltul derabanan is just a generic catch-all phrase for saying something that's only a sur mid rabbanan on Shabbat and Yom Tov. So why do I need a pasuk to tell me that you're allowed to do these items on Shabbat and Yom Tov if they're not even asur midoraita, they're only asur midorabanan. Ela, lav ki hai gavna. Isn't it in a case like this that we went ahead and it says that you have to anticipate the Shabbat, and in anticipating the Shabbat, you're allowed to do this. What is this that you're allowed to do? Rashi claims, dimutar laser al mashlo ba'al olam, batid lavo l'tzarchonik Shabbat. You're allowed to take off Trumot and Masrot in anticipation of that which is going to happen in the future in order to accomplish Onek Shabbat. And that's what the Laman Tilmad Yirat Hashem Lokecha, to anticipate Shabbat, means that you can take off Trumot and Masrot on stuff that is Shalom Badi Olam in order to accomplish Onek Shabbat, because you will be able to eat it on Shabbat. Now, the Tosafot, the Tosaf Yishanim, many Rishonim ask on Rashi, you're still only dealing with an issue, the Rabbanan. The reason that you can't be mafrish on Yom Tov and Shabbat is midi rabbanan. So to anticipate and be mafrish ahead of time, why would the Torah instruct you to do something that is only problematic midi rabbanan? That's number one. Number two is, why is this unique to Shabbat and Yom Tov? If the instruction over here is that you're allowed to take off Trumot Masrot on the Davar Shelo Ba'al Olam, it should be equally applicable on a weekday as it is on Shabbat and Yom Tov. And therefore, why is the Braita that we brought before speaking about the Shabbat and Yom Tov? For those reasons, the Ri in the Tosafot favors the understanding of the Rabbeinu Hananel, that over here, the Pasuk is being matir, one's ability to take Shalom Mina Mukaf. There is a requirement to take off Trumot Masrot Mina Mukaf from things that are present and next to each other. To take off Trumot Masrot from Tevel at somewhere else, or to have the Trumot Masrot somewhere else where the Tevel is here, that is problematic. That's a problem with Shalom Mina Mukaf. Happens to be a machloket Rishonim as to whether that problem is only Deoraita, is that problem Deoraita, or is that problem only Derabanan. But assuming that it is a problem Deoraita, what Tosafot says is that this Pasuk is matir to take off these items Shalom Mina Mukaf in order to accomplish Oneg Shabbat. From this you learn a number of things. Number one is the din of Oneg Shabbat is mi Deoraita, not mi Derabanan. Despite the fact that we bring Psukim to prove that there is Oneg Shabbat from the Nevi'im, over here, this would indicate that Oneg Shabbat is a derivative of Pasuk in the Torah, and is a Chiyuv Mideoraita. Number two is, we allow you to violate Shalom Mina Mukaf in order to accomplish Oneg Shabbat, so that you will have these items that are ready and available to eat on Shabbat itself. So Tosafot comes and asks on himself, the same problem that we have with Rashi's Pshat is that, in the end, if you're allowed to be Mafrish, Trumot, Masrot, and Shabbat, why not just wait for the items to get there? Then be mafrish mina mukaf, and you'll have both oneg Shabbat and mina mukaf. Why should we do it shalom mina mukaf in order to accomplish oneg Shabbat? So Tosafot says, because Oneg Shabbat, or part of Oneg Shabbat, is to have it prepared or anticipation of that which is going to happen. And therefore, part of the Oneg Shabbat is not to be mafrish on Shabbat itself, but to have it ready and done prior to the Shabbat. And therefore, we give it dispensation to violate Shlomin and Mukaf in order to accomplish this of having Oneg Shabbat prepared before the Shabbat. Or the other possibility Tosafot suggests is over here, we were talking about peirot, fruits, which are only chayav in Shemot and Masrot midrabanan. And since we're only dealing with an Isur derabanan, therefore we allowed Shalom Min HaMukaf for those peirot that are only chayav midrabanan in order to anticipate the mitzvah of Oneg Shabbat. So the Torah was just speaking about Oneg Shabbat in general, and it says, because of Oneg Shabbat, one should be mafrish their Trumot and Masrot prior to Shabbat, because Min HaTorah, if there was no other way to do this except Shalom Min HaMukaf, we would allow it for Oneg Shabbat. So in this case, where there might have been another alternative, but since it's only an Issur d'Rabbanan, because these are Perot d'Rabbanan, we allowed you to then do it Shalom Min HaMukaf. Now, based on the way that Tosafot is explaining this, then the proof from this case is not a direct proof. According to Rashi, the fact that they allowed it shalom ba min olam is the proof that they hold like this. Now then, according to Tosafot, the whole heter was to take shalom in a mukaf on Erev Shabbat for Oneg Shabbat. As a derivative of that, we learned that they also believe that you can take off Trumot Masrot from Davar shalom ba li olam, and that's the proof that Rabbi Yanai and Rabbi Chia believe you can do something or you can transact with something that is Davar Shalom Badi Olam. Rabbi Kiva Eger over here asks, why do we need all of this business here by the story of Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Yanai? Because we do have a principle that we've seen earlier in the Masechta that a person can be Toreim on Davar Sheino Shalom. You can be Toreim on something that is not yours. So why couldn't Rabbi Yanai be Toreim the Trumot and Masrot off of the Aris's Peirot? And since he was Toreim off the Aris's Peirot, then he would have done it at the time on Davar Shalom Badi Olam. He was doing it in the future because he was waiting for it to come into his possession. But why doesn't he just separate off the Trumot and Masrot on what the Aris is holding on the Aris's property itself? And therefore he would accomplish that and he wouldn't even have to do it on Davar Shalom Badi Olam. So the Reb Chaim on this question of the Bekiv Eger explains that there's a difference in taking off Trumot and Masrot from someone who owns property versus someone who purchases items that are Trumot and Masrot. And that there might be different levels of obligation with regards to someone who owns the fruits and vegetables and is going to sell them, versus a person who purchases them, where that obligation might not even be doraita to take off Trumot and Masrot. And since their levels of obligation were different, therefore, Rabbi Yanai could not accomplish the hafrasha Trumot and Masrot for the Aris, because he and the Aris were facing different levels of obligations vis-a-vis the separation of the Trumot and Masrot. You can see it inside if you want to see more details about how the Reb Chaim deals with this issue. When the Gemara continues, and he says, Vaha akiryon bechalma kanae retzutz, he says, Rabbi Yanai says to Rabbi Chia, but last night, on Friday night, I had a dream. In my dream, they told me about a pasuk that has kanae retzutz in it, which is a broken, bruised reed in the story. My love, Halki Gamri li, isn't this what they were hinting to me? A pasuk that has kanae retzutz in it? So he quotes the pasuk that's found in Melachim Bet, Hinei batachta lechal mish'enet hakanea ratzut, says Zeh. When Sancheriv comes to begin to lay siege on Yerushalayim, he sends Rav Shakeh ahead of him to speak to Chizkiyahu HaMelech or to his people, and he says, listen, we're coming, and nothing's going to protect you. You think you're going to rely on Mitzrayim? Mitzrayim is like a kanea ratzut. They're like a broken reed. You like lean on them, you'll get more hurt by the reed than you will by the protection that they will afford you. He goes on to say, if you think you're going to believe in Hashem and He's going to protect you, Hashem hasn't protected anyone until now. So you guys are going to be destroyed by Melech Ashur. So there, the pasuk seems to indicate that it's leaning on something that is not real. So what Rabbi Yanai interpreted his dream to mean is that here he paskin or did something halachically, and it was incorrect because he relied on the wrong halacha. So Rabbi Chia says back to him, lo, halki gamri locha. This is what they were saying to you in the dream. They were reading you this pasuk, which is kanei ratzutz lo yishbor, upishta chea lo yichabena, and then the pasuk ends, which is ulemet yotzi mishpat, which is Hashem promises that even the broken reed, even the weaker or bruised reed, will never really break. Upishta chea, and the smoking flax lo yichabena, will never be extinguished, and so too emet yotzi mishpat, truth will always bring to justice. And here also, what you did was true and just, and it is upholding or saying that what you did was actually correct. So you see that both Rabbi Yannai and Rabbi Chiya believe that you can be makne davar shelo ba de olam because of the way that Rabbi Yannai acted and the way that Rabbi Chiya upheld that psak that he had given himself. Rabbi, where do you find that Rabbi says that you can be makne davar shelo ba de olam? Titania, lo tazkir eved el adunav. You do not return a slave to his master. Rabbi Omer, what is the case where you don't return the slave to his master? Belokeach eved amanat l'shachararo. A person who purchasing an eved with a promise that he will free him. He gives him a shtar shechrur and says that when I purchase you, you will go free. That's what Ketuv Medaber, that's what this pasuk is speaking about. Hey chidami, what's the case here? Amar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak dichtiv le, he writes in a shtar, l'shekechecha, that when I purchase you, then this shtar will be effective from today immediately, that you will take possession of yourself and you will be free. Why do you have to write me'achshav? This is Tosafot, the Shita Tov, that if using a shtar, which Shechrur has done a yedei shtar, there's a risk. If the shtar is not around at the time that he buys the Eved, then it won't go into effect because the Kinyan's impact is still not there. Therefore, he uses the term achshav to ensure that the impact of the kinyan and the effectiveness of the kinyan are at the same time, and therefore the eved will go free for sure. In this case, where such a person makes such an agreement with an eved, and then he buys him and doesn't free him, or the eved runs away after he buys him, you don't return him to his master because he really is free. He won his freedom based on the promise in the shtar that his future master had granted to him. So you see again here, this is a davar shelo ba de olam. He doesn't own the eved overnight now. He cannot execute on freeing the eved now. Yet his promise to free him in the future is binding once he buys him. And so you see, you hear, you can transact about something in the future which you could not do today. Rabbi Meir, Ditznan, which is Homer Lisha Ariat Migudeshet Li, Lachar Sheet Gayer, Lachar Sheet Tidgari. It says to a woman, I will marry you after I convert, or after you convert. L'achar she'eshtachrer, after I am freed, meaning I'm an Eved Knani and after I'm freed, l'achar she'tishtachari, she's a Shifcha Knanit after you are freed, l'achar she'mot balech, after your husband passes away, l'achar she'tamot achoteich, after my wife, your sister, passes away, l'achar she'achlotz lach yivimech, after your Yavam gives you chalitza, then I will marry you because you will be muter l'shuk. Eina Mikudeshet, the Tanakhama says none of these work since you cannot affect the transaction today. You cannot do the Kiddushin today. You can't stipulate that it will happen in the future. Rabbi Meir Omer Mikudeshet. Rabbi Meir says that it is Mikudeshet, that the future transaction is effective today, even though you cannot execute on it today, because Adam is Makneh Davar Shelo Bali Olam. Rabbi Eliezer Ben Yaakov, what's the instance of Rabbi Eliezer Ben Yaakov? The Tanya. Yeter again amar Rabbi Lezmi Yaakov, afilu yim amar perot aruga zut lushim yehu truma al perot aruga ahu mechubarim. If he says that these perot in this field that are already picked, they'll be truma on the fruits of that patch that is still attached to the ground. Oh, perot aruga mechubarim, or these fruits here that are attached to the ground will be truma maser on these fruits that have already been picked. And that will come true when they reach a third of growth, and then they're picked. And sure enough, they grow to a third, and then they're picked. Then whatever he said goes effective. So here again, at the time that he's executing this, it doesn't work. Because you cannot give Trumot HaMasrot from something that's attached to the ground, and you cannot take off Trumot HaMasrot from something that's attached to the ground because it's not Tevel yet. Only becomes teva when it is ra'uy le'digun, when you can pile it up and you can process it. So when it's attached to the ground, it's not even chayav in Trumot HaMasrot. And certainly you can't take off Trumot HaMasrot from something that's attached to the ground. So in both of these instances, either the teva is attached to the ground, or the Trumot HaMasrot are attached to the ground. And Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says that in the future, you can declare that once you've picked them, that they will either become Trumot HaMasrot, or the Trumot HaMasrot I have here will be effective on them. Now, he does stipulate that they have to grow at least a shlish, they have to grow one-third, because the chiyuva trumot masrot only comes into effect after it's grown at least a third, it's matured at least a third of its growth by grains, and therefore there will only be a chiyuv trumot masrot at that point in time. So he stipulates that it has to reach the onata masrot, and then he has to pick it in order for it to be chayav. Now, the assumption must be here that he intends to pick it at the time that it reaches Onat HaMasrot. Can't be that simply that it reaches Onat HaMasrot and then he's going to pick it in the future, or he's going to pick it now even though he intended it for Ochel. It must be that he intended it for animal feed and he's going to pick it at the time that it hits one-third of its maturation. And so there he says, he stipulates that once it reaches that one-third of maturation, I pick it, it will become effective as Truma HaMaser, or the Truma HaMaser I'm taking now will be effective. When that happens, it actually will work, according to Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov. Now, according to Tosafot before, who says that the impact of the Kinyan must still be felt when you reach the effectiveness of the Kinyan, over here, the effectiveness of the Kinyan is when he actually picks the items, when they grow, and then he picks the items. At that point, he's not saying that it's going to be Truma HaMaser. He said that all the way back before. So there's actually a chiddush in Tosafot, which he notes that when a person declares something hekdesh, it's equivalent of doing a transaction with someone's hedjot. And just like by amirah, by hekdesh, you have the ability to say something, and it functions like a kinyan by hedjot, so too over here, the amirah of the Truma HaMaser has lasting impact, even though the words are only momentary, nevertheless, that impact remains in place, just like a kinyan hedjot would remain in place. If you did the kinyan through money, it would still be in effect. So too over here, even though the words are said at a single point in time, their effectiveness or their impact remains intact until the effectiveness of the kinyan or the operation, which is when he picks these items, then they will become Truma HaMaser. As if he said it at that moment, even though he said it at a much earlier time when he declared that he was going to make them Truma HaMaser. Rabbi Akiva, who is the final individual on the list, the earliest individual we have on the list, it says that Adam Makne Davar Shel Gvul Olam. It's not the Mishnah that we quote at the beginning of Tzadik Gimel Amud Aleph, which is Konam, Sheni Oseh L'Picha. If a woman takes a nether that she says that her husband cannot get any anah from her output, from her Masi Yadayim, Inu Tzarich Lafer. He doesn't have to give Hafarah according to the Chachamim because she cannot be Oser something that doesn't exist yet. That is a future production. She can't be Oser it today with her declaration. On the other hand, Rabbi Kiva Omer Yafer. Rabbi Kiva says he has to nullify it. Shema Ta'adif Alav Yotermin Aroi Lo. Because maybe she will produce in excess of what she's already obligated to him. What she's obligated to him, she cannot oser, because he has a shibud, he has a direct lien on her output, and that she cannot be oser, because it's as if it's his. So that is in exchange for mizonot, and that is in exchange for the spending money that he gives her, as Tosafot explains, based on the sugya in Nidorim. Therefore, we're talking about the extra that's on top of it, that if she produces it, who is it going to belong to? So Rabbi Kiva believes it belongs to the woman. And therefore, she could usher it, because it's Dovar Shelo Badli Olam. And since it's Dovar Shelo Badli Olam, Rabbi Akiva believes you can transact on it. And she's able to oser that thing in the future. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe that that excess of the excess still belongs to the husband. And even though they agree with Rabbi Akiva, that Dovar Shelo Badli Olam, you would be able to transact in it. Nevertheless, they say that it's not hers to transact in. You could more simply, not like Tosafot explains in Amud Aleph, just explain that the machloket here is simply about Davar Shelo Badli Olam. Because Rabbi Akiva believes Davar Shelo Badli Olam, she can be Oser, and therefore he has to be Mefer in order to avoid that problem. Whereas the Chachamim believe that she can't be Oser Davar Shelo Badli Olam, so he doesn't have to nullify it because it'll never be an issue. But Tosafot explains it based on the Ukimtor and the Gemara in the Darim as the way that we explained it first. Okay, now the Gemara moves on to another question, now that we left behind this issue of Adam Makne Davar Shelo Badli Olam. And he says, "By me name Rav Sheshet, Eid Echad Bivyama Mahu." The testimony of an Eid Echad, is it effective when it comes to allowing a woman to marry her Yavam? So now we know from the first Mishnah in the Perek that Eid Echad does work. But over there, the Eid Echad was simply telling her that her husband passed away or didn't pass away. It was giving her information that freed her to go marry out to the Shuk. Over here, in our Mishnah that we're currently working on, the Mishnah talked about Yivama, and it says Amru, that they said. So now we got this information, but the Mishnah itself doesn't say who gave us this information. Was it two Edim that gave us this information, or one Ed who gave the information? And the Gemara is uncertain as to that. Now, where the woman is believed, and the woman in a Mishnah coming up, we're going to see this on Kulf Yudalid, that the woman is believed in all these instances to give us certain pieces of information. Over here, the Gemara is assuming that an Eid Echad is actually worse than the woman herself. Because the woman herself would not lie and intentionally lie in these situations because she knows that she probably is going to get caught if she lies. And she's not willing to intentionally do something that is a lie either because she's embarrassed about it or because she knows the truth. Whatever the reason or psychological reason, she won't lie about it directly. So therefore, she has nemanut for instance, to say, and these are a number of cases here. Number one is that if she goes overseas, she is believed to say that her husband passed away. Number two is she goes overseas with her husband and her son. She's believed to say that her husband passed away and then her son passed away. Or if she went overseas without any children with her husband and she says that her husband passed away, she's believed to say that she is now up to be a Yavama and she will get married to this Yavam. So in all these cases, she is believed. There are two cases where she's not believed, which will become more relevant in the upcoming Gemara, which is she's not believed to say that my son passed away first, and then my husband passed away, and now I'm available for Yivum. Or she cannot say that my Yavam passed away, and now I'm Muteret Lashuk. So now, in these instances, where the woman is either a Pesha Asura Petra Hitir, or the woman is in a situation where she is nemenet because of a chazakah. In all those cases, we believe her. So in the case where the chachamim empowered her to be believed about her husband because we don't want her to be an aguna, she says her husband died, we believe her. And that will allow her either to be free to the shuk, or if there's a yavam, to perform yibum. If she goes out with her son and her husband, and she says, my husband passed away and then my son, she hasn't changed the status quo. When she went out, she was p'turah from the yibum. When she comes back, she's also p'turah from the yibum because she said her husband passed away first and then her son. So again, she's believed there. In the case where she says her son passed away first and then her husband, over there she's not believed because now she's trying to change the status quo. When she left, she was not readily available for Yibum because she had a son. Now she's saying that the son passed away first, then her husband, and now she's available for Yibum. There she's not believed. She's believed with regards to the death of her husband. She's not believed now about the death of her son, which is going to change her status quo. In addition to that, she's not believed to say that her Yavam passed away. Because over there, what shaykhut does she have? She's believed in regards to her husband. She's not necessarily believed according to the Yavam. So now what the Gemara wants to know over here is, we know that the woman is believed in certain of these instances, but when an Eid Echad comes, is he also believed? And again, as we explained before, Tosafot says over here that there is more likelihood that she will tell the truth and be careful about what she does than when there is an aid over there. Once she has an aid that is aiding and abetting her in her testimony or in her desire to be freed, then will she go ahead and loosen up and do things a little less carefully? And therefore, with an Eid Echad, we are going to have to be more suspicious than when she brings us the testimony itself. That's the underlying assumption of this piece of the Gemara, and that's what the Gemara is asking over here. Eid Echad b'yivama mahu. Our Mishnah, if the woman came along and said to us that her husband passed away, we would believe her. If she said her husband passed away and now she has to perform Yibum because there's a brother, we would believe her, and she would go on to have to perform Yibum. Question is, then when the Mishnah says Amru, is that saying two Eidim? Or is that even true by an Eid Echad? And this is the way the Gemara phrases the question. Time of Eid Echad, what's the reason we believe in Eid Echad? Mishum de milta davida ligluye lo mishaker. Something that in the future will become revealed, people don't lie about. Vachanami lo mishaker. So also over here, the Eid Echad has no vested interest in lying, neither does the woman, because it's something that in the future will be found out. Or maybe what the reason is that an Eid Echad is believed, Mishum de'i daiko minsaba, is because she, after hearing the testimony of the Eid Echad, checks into it very carefully and makes sure of the veracity of the aid. Now, Tosfot points out, we already saw this in the Gemara. The Gemara was clear that the reason we believe the Eid Echad is because we trust the woman then to go and make a strong investigation into the matter. So Tosfot rephrases the question in a little more nuanced way and says, listen, everybody agrees that the woman is going to check into it. But what type of check do we assume the woman's going to do? Do we assume the woman's going to do a partial check? Well, the reason that we believe the Eid Echad is because the woman's going to do a partial check, plus the fact that the testimony of the aid can be checked. So those two things together give us extra nemanut in the aid, and that's why we believe her. Or do we say that the reason that the Eid Echad is believed is because this woman's going to do a full-fledged investigation afterwards, and that's what drives all the nemanut over here? The nafkamina is in the case of Yivama, where she has another factor that might influence the way that she treats the situation. And that is what the Gemara says over here. V'acha, kevin de zimnen de rachmalei. Sometimes there is a case where this woman likes her Yavam, lo daiko o mintzva, and therefore she won't do a full investigation because she has a vested interest in her husband being dead so that she can marry this Yavam. So the difference will be exactly this, as the way Tosfot phrased it. If we require a full-fledged investigation, this woman's not going to do that because she has ulterior motives here. She really wants to marry the Yavam, so she'll only do a cursory check, and that's not enough. On the other hand, if you believe the reason that Erechad works is because the combination of her check plus the Ne'emanut of the Erechad because he won't lie because in the future we'll know about it, then she only needs a small check. And also over here, she'll do a check. She won't do a deep check, but that's sufficient in order for the Erechad to be believed. And so that's what the Gemara is asking. So Amar Lo Rav Sheshe Tinitua. It's our Mishnah. Amru La Meit Benech V'Acharkach Meit Baleich. A case where they came and told her that your son passed away and then your husband passed away. And then she went ahead and she performed Yibum. V'acharkach amrule, and then all of a sudden she got new information that said, amrula, they came and said to her, chiluf advarim. It was just the opposite. The husband died first and then the child and she wasn't up for Yibum. Teitzei, vavla rishom achron mamzer. She has to get divorced and the children born before the news and after the news are all mamzerim. So Rav Sheshet says, hechidami, what was this case in the Mishnah? Ilei metrei utrei. If you say that two edim came at first and said, he died after the child. And then two edim later came and said, no, he died before the child. That's trey utrei. My chazit de samchet ahani, samuchani. Why would you believe one set of edim over the other set of edim? This is basically edut mucheshet. And edut mucheshet, we leave it at the status quo. Whatever is true now remains as the status quo. And even though the chazoko here is that the avam is asura to her, nevertheless, if she says bari li, or he says bari li, then we will allow them to go through, and that will become the status quo. We won't change it because you have two against two. Vote mamzer. The Mishnah says that they are definitely mamzerim. Safek mamzer who? It's a safek. You have two on each side of this situation. Then it's possible it's a mamzer, but it's not for sure a mamzer. V'chitei malo dak. If you say the Mishnah wasn't so exact, and when it said mamzer, it meant a safek mamzer. V'hamiktani seifa harishon mamzer v'acharon enu mamzer. When the later on in the Mishnah it says that those before the Shmua are Mamzerim, those after the Shmua are not Mamzerim, Shma Mina Dafka Ktani, there it's definitely being exact, and therefore when it said Mamzer, it means Mamzer Vadai, it doesn't mean Mamzer Safek. So then how are you going to explain this case in the Mishnah? Ella Lav Shma Mina Chad, that the reason that this works is that it is one aid that came originally. V'tayma Da'atu Beitre Achashua. And the only reason that the aid Achad lost his Nemanut is because two aidim came later and undermined his testimony. Had it not been for that, the Erechad would have been Ne'eman. So what Rav Sheshet says is the case in our Mishnah must be a case where an Erechad came and we believed him like two Edim. Erechad came and said, your son passed away, then your husband passed away, and therefore she's up for Yibum. And so you see from our Mishnah that an Erechad is Ne'eman in that situation in order to grant her the right to go ahead and get married to the Yavam. That's only because two Edim came back later and said that, no, he wasn't that way. It was just the opposite, that he died first and then the son died, that we say now that we undermine or we change the status of the first aid's testimony because now it's two against one. And two against one, even though the first aid was Ne'eman k'beitre, once we have two Edim, full-fledged Edim coming up against him, we're going to say that aid does not count against these two Edim and we're going to force her to get divorced. Now, the truth is that the proof that Rav Sheshet brings is actually slightly different than the question that we asked. We asked, is an Erechad Ne'eman to say that she can marry the Yavama, which is a case in which she says that the husband passed away and now she's available for the Yavam. In that case, she's believed. And so too, we were asking, is the Erechad also believed in that case? Rav Sheshet's proof is from our Mishnah, which is a case in which the Erechad comes and says that the child died first and then the husband. In that case, the woman is not believed in that case. She's not Ne'emanit in that case. So now Rav Sheshet's proof is saying that here you have an Erechad that's Ne'eman, even in a place where the woman is not believed. So it must be that that was the original intention of the Gemara to ask on both of these issues. Although the Ritva is Medayik from Rashi that he doesn't say that the Gemara's question was about a Yivama. And Rav Sheshet's answer is about that which he can prove, not about Yivama. That was not the original intention of the Gemara's question, but nevertheless Rav Sheshet brought it because that's where he had the proof from in the Mishnah. Now the Gemara says, V'ike da'amar, halo tibayiloch, dafilu hi nami mehemna. So in the second Lashon, as Tosfot explains over here, the second Lashon changes its view and says, listen, if the woman is believed, then certainly an Eid Echad is believed. So anywhere where the woman is believed, we're definitely going to believe in Eid Echad. And since the woman is believed to say her husband passed away and then to enter into Yibum, so too an Eid Echad will also be believed in that case, and that was not the question that was being asked over here. But rather, the question is something else, which we'll see in a second. It's none, because we have a Mishnah further on that says, Aisha Shamra Beit Bali Tinasei. She says, my husband passed away, she's allowed to get married to a third party. Meit Bali, and there is a brother, Titya Beim. So therefore, if she's believed, then certainly the Eid Echad is believed. So at this point in time, the Gemara is suggesting, as opposed to the first case where we said that the woman herself would not lie because she wouldn't intentionally speak Sheker, and just because she likes the Yavam, she's going to go ahead and lie b'mezid about it because there's still much risk in whether that will actually be carried out, so she won't lie. But when she has the Eid Echad abetting her in that case, then maybe she won't check so carefully because she likes the outcome of the situation. So in that case, we said the Eid Echad was worse than the woman herself. In this lashon, we say just the opposite. We say that the woman is believed, even though she's a nogea b'davar. On the other hand, the Eid Echad was not nogea b'davar, al chad kama v'kama, that we should believe that Eid Echad. So based on that, if the woman is na'amenet to say that her husband passed away, and she can perform Yibum, or her husband passed away and she's free to go out to the shuk, then certainly an Eid Echad is believed in that case. Now, that only answers really the first question that the Gemara answered before, which is Yivama. Because in the case where it's her son that passed away first, and then her husband passed away, there the woman is not believed. But the Gemara is saying here that the Ne'manut of this Eid Echad is premised on the fact that if the woman's believed, then he certainly is believed. But from the nature or the way that the Gemara continues over here, it seemingly says that whatever Rosh Hashanah had said before, here the Eid Echad is definitely believed. And Tosfot presents that as two options in the Gemara here. Tosfot says, Anechanami, the question of the Gemara here is going to be one thing, but it could have asked this question as well, which is in the case where it's Meit B'neich, V'achar Kach Meit Baleich, which she's not believed, do we allow the Eid Echad to come in? The Gemara didn't ask that question, it asked another question, which will also answer this question. Or, maybe the Gemara does assume that even though she's not believed in that case, nevertheless, the Eid Echad is believed. And that might be because we already proved that we don't worry about the fact that the woman might actually like the Yavam and then intentionally testify in order to get to be married to this Yavam. Because in the case where she says her husband passed away and she's going to marry the Yavam, we believe her. So we have already taken away that consideration. If that's the case, when she says, Meit B'neich, V'achar Kach, Meit Baleich, if she says that, then she should have been believed in that case anyway. She's not believed because the Chachamim only granted her Nemanut with regards to her husband so that she would not be an Aguna, but they didn't grant her that special Nemanut when it comes to her son that would allow her to marry the Yavam. So the Chachamim didn't give her those extra powers of believability, even though she checks carefully. But together with the Eid Echad, there we will believe her, and therefore she's granted that Nemanut. So then the Gemara's question is only the following question, which is, Kiti Bailach, the Mishrei Yavama the Alma. Do we believe the Eid Echad to discharge her and allow her to be now free to the Shuk? And that is because, my time, the Eid Echad, what's the reason why Eid Echad mishum de milta David leglue lo mishaker? Something that's going to be revealed, he doesn't lie. Hachinami lo mishaker. Or Dilma, time of Eid Echad mishum de daiko mintzaba is because she really checks into it. Valo daiko mintzaba. Over here, she's not going to check so carefully when the Eid Echad comes and says that she is muteret le Shuk because demisno Disanule, she hates her Yavam. And since she hates her Yavam, she doesn't want to marry him. So she's willing to believe the Eid Echad and not check into it. So similar to the way that Tosafot phrased the question before, is the Nemanut here based on the fact that we combine the fact that she checks a little bit plus the fact that he won't lie because it'll be revealed in the future? Those two together, packaged together, make the Eid Echad Neman. If that's the case over here too, she's not going to check so carefully because she hates her Yavam. We still believe her because she'll check a little bit. We have the Eid Echad, that's good. Or do we say the reason that Eid Echad is Neman is because she checks very carefully? And over here she has a disincentive to check carefully because the Eid Echad is testifying about her being freed from her Yavam. And that's what she wants. That's the outcome that she's looking for. And therefore we're going to say that she doesn't check so carefully and the Eid Echad should not be Neman in this case. Like in a case where she says, Mate Yavimi, where am I? Yavam passed away. She's not believed. So is the Eid Echad believed in that case when he says that the Yavam passed away and she's not up for Yibum at this point in time? So Amar Lo Rav Sheshet Tinitua. We can learn it out from the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Amrulah Meit Baleich V'achar Kach Meit B'neich. In a case where they said her husband passed away first and then her son, Vini Seit, and she got married. V'achar Kach Amrulah Chiluf Ayu Dvarim. And then they have new Eidim come and say it was just the opposite. Teitzei V'avlad Rishon V'acharon Mamzer. She has to divorce and the first and latter children are considered to be mamzerim before and after the Shmua. Hey, Chidami, again, what's the case? Ilei metrei utrei. If we're talking about a case where it's two Eidim against two Eidim, my chazit de samach tahani, samuch ani. If you, why would you rely on these Eidim and not on the other Eidim? V'od, mamzer, safek mamzeru. What are you saying? He's a mamzer vada. He's really only a safek mamzer over here. V'chitei melo dak. And you say the mission's not exact. Hamiltoni Sefer, the latter half of the Mishnah says, Arishon Mamzer, Achron Enu Mamzer, and that is Bidiyuk, that is Dafko. So the first part of the Mishnah must be Dafko, also a real Mamzer. Shmamina, the Dafko Dani. So it's clear that this is speaking in absolute terms. El Alab, what must be the case here? Chad, that the original aid was only one aid. The one aid came and said that your husband passed away, and then your son, and therefore you do not have to get married to the Yavam. Bataimo Da'atu Beitrei. And then afterwards, two Edim come and say, Achashua, and they disagree and say, that's not the case. It was the other way around. The son died first, and then the husband, you're up for Yibum. So they undermine the Edut of the first Eid. Halav Hachi. Had it not been for the two Edim that came afterwards, Mehemen, he would have been believed. So we see over here, by the Eid Achad, we don't worry about the fact that she might hate her Yavam. Tosafot raises a number of issues over here, which are very interesting. Didn't we already establish in this version of the Gemara, that we don't worry about the fact that she might really like her Yavam, and we're not suspicious of the fact that she would testify about something just to get married to the Yavam, and that's why the Eid Echad is believed over here. Why all of a sudden here does the Gemara now worry about the fact that she might hate him, and she would not be believed because we assume she hates him? So Tosafot says that that is a psychological phenomenon, that people's hate is much greater than their love. And therefore, even though love might prompt them to do something silly, hatred would definitely prompt them to do something even much worse. And he explains why, because in the case of love, she has other options, meaning that even if it doesn't work out with this guy, she still has other options. In the end, she could marry other people. Over here, if she gets stuck with this guy who she hates, she has no way out of this situation, and therefore she's really in trouble. So therefore she's much more willing to bend the truth in that case. And that's what our suspicion over here is, that maybe she would bend the truth or not tell the truth in that case. And then also, on top of that, do we then worry about the Eid Echad? When the Eid Echad, does he have a nemanut independent of the suspicion about how she's going to treat the situation? So Rav Sheshet's answer is yes. In Eid Echad is believed in our Mishnah to say that, meit baleich v'achar kach meit b'neich, and to be poter her. So we see that the Eid Echad is believed, even though she has a vested interest in seeing this be the outcome. So we see that sin'ah is not a factor over here. And so too in the case where the aid just comes to testify that the Yavama passed away, we're going to believe him even though we don't believe the woman herself, because the Eid Echad has nemanut, and we don't worry about her hating the Yavam as being a contributing factor. Now Tosafot does point out something interesting, which is that in the case where she says, meit bali v'achar kach meit b'ni, and she's patur from the Yavam, we believe her there. So of course we're going to believe the Eid Echad in that case. The answer is no, because she has a migo. She has a migo because she left with the child there already. And so migo that she could have said nothing to us about the child, the fact that she told us that the child passed away, we believe her, because she could just said the child was alive and still be protected from Yibum. So that's why she believed. The Eid Echad doesn't have that migo, and that's what the Gemara's question is the Eid Echad Neman in that case? Is Eid Echad Neman in the case where she has a vested interest in seeing that her Yavam is not going to marry her? And because of that, we won't believe the Eid Echad, or is the Eid Echad believed anyway? And that's what Rav Sheshet says. Our Mishnah shows you the Eid Echad is believed anyway. And so then we can extrapolate that to the case where she's just testifying about the Yavam, where she's not believed, but the Eid Echad will be believed because the Eid Echad stands on his own. That he is Neman, and it doesn't matter what her emotions are about this case, the Eid Echad is still Neman in all these cases. The Gemara says, maybe not. To all these proofs of Rav Sheshet, the Olam Trei Utrei. Maybe all these cases in our Mishnayot are dealing with a case where there are two Edim against two Edim. Ugdama Rav Acha Bar Nyume. But it's similar to the way that Rav Acha Bar Nyume sets it up. The way we assume Dindel now is these are two Edim arguing with each other, two sets of two Edim arguing with each other, and it's an Eden Mucheshet. But the case could be a case where Eden Hazama. It's a case where two Edim came along and disqualified the original Edim. Hachanami Beide Azama. That's exactly what's happening here. The second set of Edim are coming and saying about the first set of Edim, Imanu Aitem, you were with us the whole time. And since you were with us, you can't testify the fact that whatever information is true. And they are posel the first set of Edim. It's Gzerata Ketuv, that by Hazama, the second set of Edim are believed. Versus a case where it's Eid Mucheshet, where they are stuck. It's a hung testimony, and therefore we'll go with the status quo or the chazakah that's in place. But over here we have Hazama, the second set of Eidim, disqualified through saying that the first set of Eidim were with them the whole time, and therefore could not testify. The second Eidim, Trump, and therefore they're believed. And that's the way we can explain our Mishnah. There's really two sets of two Eidim, but the second Eidim are not testifying to deny what the first Edim say about the facts, but they're saying that you couldn't testify about the facts because you were with us, and that's Hazama, and they could disqualify those Edim, and that's why we rely on the second set of Edim. that's the case, our Mishnah is not talking about a case of 1-8, and therefore the proofs that Rav Sheshet brought do not hold or do not help us in answering the questions that we posed. So we're going to stop here, 11 lines down on Tzadik Dalet Amud Aleph. Tzadik Dalet Amud Aleph.